Well, the first couple of slides are just background. In a way, I am going to repeat some of the things that were said on Monday by my colleague, Shashi, who also talked about the vorticities. Well, consider a system of endpoint vortices on the plane, each with a complex coordinate, x alpha plus I, y alpha. So we have n vortices, with each one with strength gamma alpha. It is known that the equations of motion are of this manner, which remind a little bit the equations of motion in celestial mechanics, except that we would have here a 3, and this would be a second order equation instead of a first order equation. These equations are derived from Euler's equation via its formulations in terms of the vorticity field, taking the limit when the vorticity is concentrated at discrete points. So that's the main theoretical idea. And for us, it's going to be relevant to consider some conserved quantities that arise in this problem. Here's the table of the main four conserved quantities and the associated symmetry to which they the associated symmetry for the quantities. So the first one is the center of circulation, which is analogous to the center of mass. Theta naught is the moment of circulation, which is defined here. It's very much like the inertia of the system. Phi naught is the vorticity flux, and I naught is the virial, which turns out to be just a constant that depends on the gammas. We think of the gammas a little bit like the masses, like the analogous of the masses in celestial mechanics. There is another conserved quantity that I would call M, will appear in the talk, and it's defined in this way, but it's not a new quantity. It can be expressed in terms of the other two quantities in the table in the previous slide. And in particular, it's going to be convenient to think that the center of vorticity is at the origin. So basically, M and theta naught, the inertia and M, will be just the same quantity. They will be proportional. Gamma here is the total vorticity, the sum of the vorticity. Now, this system is Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is given by that expression. Sum of interaction terms between the vorticities, and the interaction term is a logarithm weighted by the product of the vorticities. And the symplectic form that one uses is this symplectic form. And the Hamiltonian and symplectic form are invariant with respect to translations and rotations. And then one has, with respect to this precise action, basically just translations and rotations. And it has an associated momentum map that is of this form. Here appears again the inertia, or moment, and theta naught. And since in the we will later make this zero, basically the momentum map will be just theta naught. I'll remind you what theta naught is. How do you do this? Theta naught is the moment of circulation, which I call the inertia in this guy. So maybe I will write it. Use it later. All right. Yes, that's correct. It's the total vorticity. Let's focus on three vortices, and let's pass to the following coordinates. Let's define bi to be the distance between two vortices square, right? So this would be b1, this would be b2, and this would be b3. Actually, this would be the length. And then the bi would be li square, right? So it's the square of the length. Obviously, this transformation automatically is SE2 invariant. And if one thinks of, it's interesting to think of the space of beta i's, right? So let S be the space of beta I's. Okay? We can call this guy the shape space of the cone, shape space, or we can also call it congruence congruence equivalence classes. So this is a little bit from what Richard was talking about yesterday. He was talking about the shape sphere, which is the space of similarity equivalence classes, and also in his case, he also considers orientation. Well, I call it the shape space cone because it has a very simple geometric interpretation. If we think, obviously the VIs are positive, so this triple lives in the first octant in R3. But not every point in this first octant will define a triangle, because a triangle has to satisfy the triangle inequalities, right? So not every point here will give you actually a triangle. So the set that will give you a triangle is actually a cone, which is defined by considering the circle that is tangential to the three Cartesian axes, and that passes here by to 1, 1, 1. Let's fill this circle so we get a disk. And then we consider the cone over this disk, right? So we just join, consider all the lines that pass through the origin and one point in this disk, right? So this disk, we'll get a cone. So that's why I call it the cone of shape space. And just to put this in context with what has been said yesterday, this disk would actually be the set of similarity classes, equivalent classes. And still it's not Montgomery's shape sphere. But if you go to the kitchen of a Mexican restaurant, you will notice that when they throw the tortillas on the pan, the tortillas start to inflate, right? So you can think of this disc as a tortilla. You throw it to the pan, and it will start to inflate. And then each side of the tortilla will be an orientation. And then when it inflates, it's actually the shape sphere that Montgomery that we have to here in the walls. Yes, and the equator of the sphere would be the boundary of this disk, which this boundary represents collinear states, and binary collisions will be these points. So this will be binary collisions. Okay. So, but actually I'm not going to work much with either D or F bar. I'm going to remove the bar of ES in a minute. But first, I'll mention that the equations of motion in this space are very simple as well. These are the equations of motions, a first order differential system, differential equations. But the bad thing about these equations is that they are not Hamiltonian. In fact, they are not even smooth near collinear configurations, right? They are not even smooth. Now, a computation of the Poisson bracket, I mean, in C3 we have the canonical Poisson bracket, and a computation of the Poisson bracket between the functions B1, B2, B3, and another function, the oriented area, is given in these two equations. These are the Poisson brackets. Now, these Poisson brackets suggest something very interesting. There is a relationship between the area, which I am calling delta. So delta is the area, capital delta is the area of the triangle. And the area is obviously not an independent quantity, because it depends on B1, B2, and B3 through Heron's formula. So of course it wouldn't make sense to consider delta as an independent coordinate. It wouldn't make sense. But anyway, let's consider it as an independent coordinate, even if it sounds crazy, but let's consider it. And one observes that by adding delta as an independent parameter of the B1, B2, and B3, we get back the Hamiltonian nature of the system. I found this idea in, I'll have to give some reference here. Well, let me give the reference first. I found this idea in Borisov, Pavlov, Lebedev, Volsinov, and Mamayev in a series of papers from 1998-1999. And it's a great idea. And of course, if we do the projection from C3 to this S, I'll call this, so that S bar is that the cone of shape space, and then S without the bar will be just B1, B2, B3, and delta. So the set of all these guys, right? Now, so this is of course SE2 invariant, and thus induces a Poisson bracket over S defined in the obvious way. The vector gamma 2, gamma 3, gamma 3, gamma 1, gamma 1, gamma 2, 0, that vector is in the kernel of this of the Poisson structure, and therefore one verifies that M, this M, where's the M? I erased it. I didn't erase it. Remember that M was defined as, well, it's there, is that, but it's basically gamma, I don't know if this gamma is to the minus one or like that, but basically they are proportional. So we find that M is that quantity, and therefore is a linear Casimir of the Poisson structure. Now, another Casimir, interestingly, is given by this function. This is another Casimir of the Poisson structure. And if you remember your high school geometry class, maybe you remember that the square root of this guy from here to there is actually the area. So F equals to 0 is equivalent to Heron's formula expressing the area of the triangle in terms of the square of the length of the sides. So we will call F Heron's function. So of course, the meaningful physical movements will occur in this level set, in the level set F equals 0. Now in that paper that I mentioned, an isomorphism is established between this big shape space, I'm going to call this the big shape space. Big shape space. F. or its dual. And the matrix Lie algebra A3. Now, the matrix Lie algebra A3 is generated by these three matrices. And the Lie isomorphism is actually obtained by identifying B1 with B1 tilde, that matrix, B2 with B2 tilde, etc. And the area with that matrix. And using this commutator as the commutator for the algebra. Now, it happens that this vortex Lie algebra, I call it the vortex Lie algebra A3, is isomorphic, Lie isomorphic to the Lie algebra of the unitary group dimension of U2, excuse me. The way I convince myself about this is by checking that one can construct a transformation that takes the basis B1 tilde, B2 tilde, B3 tilde, delta tilde to the basis, the standard basis of U2, which are the Pauli matrices, right? Pauli matrices. And basically, it's the sketch of the transformation is here, but I will not go into details. So that's the way one checks that A3 is isomorphic to U2, and that implies that the big shape space S with the Poisson bracket that comes or is inherited from C3 is isomorphic to the dual of the Lie algebra of U2 with the Lie Poisson bracket. Now, once we are in U2 star, we start thinking about coadjoint orbits. No? And then we go back to Marsden's book, and then we check some theorems. First theorem is that the coadjoint orbits are the symplectic leaves of the dual of the Lie algebra. Another theorem is that a function C over G star is constant over coadjoint orbits if and only if C is a Casimir. No? So just from these two theorems, one concludes that for a given value of M, the three vortex problem dynamics takes places on a coadjoint orbit in U star 2. And if we want physical orbits, we will, of course, stay in F equals 2. Now, this sounds very abstract to me, so I wanted to actually do the computation and see how this is implemented. So I'll show this to you. I'll represent elements in the Lie group, U2, as the 2x2 complex matrices such that A dagger A is the identity. And that implies that U2 is represented by the 2x2 anti-Hermitian complex matrices such that the dagger of C is minus C. So from here, we see that the general form of C is of this manner. Alpha 1 and alpha 2 are real, and zeta is a complex number. Now we can, in order to make things concrete, we need to introduce a pairing between U2 and its dual, given usually one introduces that pairing, the trace. And then parametrizing an element in the dual of the Lie algebra in this manner, the pairing looks just like the dot product in R4, right? So that's a nice way of working with things. Now, the adjoint action in U2 is just basically that conjugation. That's the adjoint action in U2. And that implies that the coadjoint action in U star 2 is given also in the same way. And since the determinant and the trace are conjugate invariants, we conclude that the coadjoint orbits are labeled. The coadjoint orbits in U star are labeled by the determinant that by the constant that is the determinant of mu and the constant that is the trace of mu. So we have a way of labeling the coadjoint orbits. Now we recall that I am parameterized an element in the dual in this manner, and I compute that the determinant of mu is that thing there, and that the trace is that thing there. So it would look a little bit simpler if I make this change of coordinates. So I introduce two new coordinates, M and Z, and with this change of coordinates, I compute that this thing that is going to be a constant and this thing minus this thing that's also a constant is this thing, V1 minus V2 squared plus square. So this minus comes because I have a 4 there, right? So that's why I get a minus here. And of course, this is just X squared plus Y squared plus C squared. So that's going to be a constant. And we conclude that the coadjoint orbits in U star 2 are characterized by the condition that if we represent an element and you start in this way with m, x, y, and z, then m has to be constant, and x squared plus y squared plus z squared have to be constant. Now, let phi be the Poisson isomorphisms that go from the big shape space to U star 2. So the Poisson isomorphism obtained by identifying the canonical basis in R4, I mean, identifying this with R4, I am identifying S with R4, with the dual basis of this basis, right? This is a basis in U2, and the dual basis would be a basis of U star 2. Then a computation shows that phi is actually given by this formula. Phi is given by this formula. And what we observe here is B1 plus B2 plus B3. Let's remember what B1 squared plus B2 squared. Oh, I forgot to say, here I'm assuming that, oh, this was very important, I should have mentioned it. At some point, I started assuming that all the vorticities are equal. Right? All the vorticities are equal. This can be generalized, but at the moment, all the vorticities are equal. So this is, and if we assume that the vortices are 1, this is gamma, zeta 1 minus zeta 2 squared plus zeta 2 minus zeta 3 squared plus zeta 3 minus zeta 1 squared. Well, this is precisely m, right? This is precisely m. So that's why I'm calling this little m. So actually, capital M will be 6 times little m. X, Y, and Z have those expressions, a little bit more complicated. And Heron's function has this very neat expression. Heron's function is x squared plus y squared plus z squared minus m squared. So as I mentioned, capital M is basically little m. And thus, the condition that we are going to stay on the Casimir F equals 0 is given by the condition that x squared plus y squared plus z squared is m squared. So this m can be viewed as the radius of a sphere. Right? Now, what about the energy? I'll come back to that sphere. But first, we need to... I want to proceed a little bit in the way one does the analysis of the rigid body. In the rigid body, one computes the quadjoint orbits, identify the dual of the Lie algebra with R3, and those quadjoint orbits are spheres. And then to obtain the orbits in that sphere and obtain the nice picture that is in the front of Jerry's book, one intersects that sphere with energy levels. So here the energy, when one passes through these coordinates, is given in this manner. Notice that it does not depend on y. Depends on x, but not on y. So the energy levels will be just cylinders. I mean, here are level sets in the, I guess, xz. This is x, and this is z. And so for a fixed m, these are the energy levels in the xz plane. And if we intersect that with the sphere, we obtain this. So this is the three vortex dynamics with equal vorticity. And this is the dynamics intersecting the constant energy cylinders with the sphere of radius m. So let's move it a little bit. Just that. I hope this works. So this is the sphere. It looks a little bit like the rigid body sphere, but anyway, it's not the same. Well, see, we have 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, and then the south points. So, yeah, there are three saddle points which correspond to the three binary collisions. And three, I have five centers. So three of them correspond to equally, I mean, the Z equals zero corresponds to zero area. One of the axes is actually the area. I forgot to mention that. So three of the centers, I think, correspond to equally spaced vortices. And the north and south pole correspond to equilateral triangles. So the three possible ways in which I can have three equally spaced vortices plus the equilateral triangles are the five centers. Yeah. Oh, no, 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 no. Something, I'm doing something wrong. So one, the North Pole is a center, but not the South Pole is not there. So how is this working? So I don't have five. I have, how many I have? This is one, two, three, four, and then I have one in the back, yeah. And this one, right? Five. Yeah. Yeah. Three of the centers represent equilateral. No, three of the centers represent equally distributed point vortices, and then I guess the north pole represents equilateral triangle. Is that correct? It has to be divided by reflection. So let me. No, I see what I'm. No, 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 no. I see. You see, this guy in front. No, I was all mixed up. This guy in front has a center on the antipode. So those are the equilateral triangles. So yes. And then the other three. Yeah, I was mixed up. So this guy here is one equilateral triangle. The antipode here is the other equilateral triangle with the opposite orientation. And these three guys, these two and the one in the back, are the equally distributed positions. Binary collisions. Yes, except that you will not get there, right? It will take infinite time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's here. And how much time do I have left? Yeah, I probably finished before 10 minutes. So let me ask the question, what can this be good for? What can this picture be good for? So this is the previous slide. So in collaboration with Banavara Shashinkant, who gave a talk on Monday and is here, we have looked at the geometric phase on closed loops in this quadjoint orbit. Basically, this quadjoint orbit, I will call the quadjoint orbit. That sphere is going to call PM. M is basically the momentum map, because I remember many slices back, I convince you, well, I mentioned that the J of P is basically theta naught comma zeta naught. There are some constants here. I think this is I gamma. So if I fix the center of vorticity in zero, then it's just theta naught, which is M, right? So M is the radius of that sphere is basically the momentum map. So that quadjoint orbit I will call the reduced symplectic. It actually is the reduced symplectic space, parameterized by the momentum map. The radius is the parameter, momentum map. And then if we look at closed loops in that sphere, it's natural to ask what is the geometric phase associated to that. To do that, we first have to introduce a connection. And for that, we use the natural metric. This is the natural metric in the system. We go back. Let's talk about n vortices. And this metric, it's just the sum of gamma k times the pairing, the Euclidean pairing. This is just the real part of the Hermitian pairing. Let V be the vertical bundle induced by the SO2 action. So for convenience, let's think that the center of vorticity is at the origin. Since the center of vorticity is a conserved quantity, there's just a remaining overall SO2 action. And let's define the metric orthogonal connection by, well, we have n vortices, but since we fix the center of vorticity there at the origin, actually our space that I will call E is Cn minus 1. So the bundle is divided, is split in the horizontal part and the vertical part, we're using the metrical orthogonal connection. And one defines the vertical and horizontal operators associated to the vertical and horizontal spaces, and the associated one form. Basically, the vertical part of a vector is associated with an element of the Lie algebra, so that is the connection one form. And if we parameterize PM in spherical coordinates, since it's a sphere, the natural way of parameterizing it is in spherical coordinates. So this is theta, and this angle is phi. We computed that the connection one form is that, is minus cosine of phi over 2 d theta. So the geometric phase, for those that are not familiar with this idea, is that if using that connection, I lift a closed loop on PM, this thing is the geometric phase, which is defined by the integral of the connection one form. And using Stokes' theorem, what do I get here? This is the area form in the sphere, so it's basically just the area of the closed loop in the quadjoint orbit. Where do I get that one half from? I don't know. I need to check. I just got it that way. Yeah. Probably I have to double check this one half. And another interesting bit of information is that we also computed the dynamic phase. So the dynamic, once you sit on a train that goes through a lifted curve using the connection, of course that lifted curve will not coincide with the actual curve given by the flux of the Hamiltonian vector fields. So if you integrate the difference, that difference is called the dynamic phase, and basically by definition is this integral. Well, we compute that this integrand is a constant, very much like it happens with the rigid body, that the dynamic phase is proportional to the period of the of the loop. And that's basically where we are at. And I have a question for you guys. I mean, I don't know if this is if this is a very well-known fact. I mean, what I have presented to you is very well-known fact. I think that the fact that the geometric phase is the area, it's more or less expected, but I don't know if this is very well known. I would like to explore how relevant is all this. And of course, one next thing that we should work is to generalize for different vorticities. Here I'm assuming that all the vorticities are the same, and one should generalize for different vorticities. I think I will stop here. Yes. Some of the things that I mentioned actually were generalized by the same people that I mentioned, and since I knew that somebody was going to ask me, these are the AN. So for N vortices, you get the vortex algebra is generated by these matrices. So for N vortices, you of course look at the square of the distances between two vortices and look at the areas formed by three three guys, right? And if you identify those guys with these matrices, that would be the algebra, the vortex algebra associated to that n vortex problem. And it can be verified that if all the vorticities are equal, the vortex algebra AN is Lie isomorphic with U N minus 1. If all the vortices have the same sign. If they don't have the same sign, then you can also say something that's a little bit more complicated. Yeah, so I said that the three vortex problem was like the Kepler problem because it's integrable. And for n bigger than 3, it's non integrable. Yes. Thank you. I leave it there. Thanks.
I've heard him speak on the three vortex
problem. Whom?
Hassan
Arif. Ah, Hassan Arif. Okay. Yeah, he has
some.
Yeah, actually, to do these computations, I also use some tools in one of Arif's papers.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm more or less familiar also with him. Yeah, probably I first encountered actually this formula in one of RF's papers. Yeah, so to these computations, I actually use some of his stuff. Yeah, thanks for the reference. Ah, thank you.
It's the same shapes. On the nose, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just your interpretations are different because it's.
Mm-hmm.
The C3 is based on that configuration.
Mm-hmm.